Penguin Random House Audio presents Fatal Gambit, a novel by David Lagercrantz, translated by Ian Giles, read for you by Simon Vance. Prologue. On June 1st, 2004, a Hungarian businessman with uncommonly strong powers of deduction received a call to his desk landline. The conversation fell into a familiar category, analysis of the surrounding world, and no one could have foreseen that anything important or decisive would be discussed. However, since the analyst who called that day had an optimistic outlook on the world at large, aside from the situation in Iraq, he prattled on about all sorts of things, and happened to mention Professor Hans Recke. I hear Recke is taking an interest in the death of Claire Lidman. That was all. But it was enough to make the Hungarian businessman feel that the whole world was changing hue. Though, of course, the story had begun much earlier. Chapter 1. Hans Recke was only 12 years old at the time. The snow was falling very heavily when the doorbell rang in the grand house in Vienna. Dr. Brandt, his mathematics teacher, stepped inside wearing a vastly oversized fur hat. With him was a boy of Recke's age with curly hair and dark, intense eyes. Dr. Brandt introduced him as Gabor, and Hans proffered his hand. It lingered alone in midair, the boy slipping by, sinuous as a cat. There was something threatening about him, and Hans could not understand what was going on. The boy's gaze shone green, and in every one of his movements there was a vigilance, a readiness. The two of them were placed at the large desk beside the bookshelf with the Beethoven bust, and only then did things become a little clearer. The boy was evidently a talent of some kind, and the idea was for them to compete and measure themselves against each other. Dr. Brandt issued them their tasks on Cantor's mathematical proof of infinities, and at once an intense tension arose. The boy, Gabor, was trembling with eagerness and set to work immediately. Hans, however, remained still, staring at the contours of the boy's shoulder muscles. "Why are you not writing?" Dr. Brandt asked. "I'm going to," he said. But he was wrapped up in his thoughts, consumed by a riddle that was more alluring than mathematics. And he watched in amazement as the boy performed calculations at lightning speed, a virtuoso, almost. Hans decided to let him win. What do I care? Nevertheless, something within him wanted to fight back, and he slowly worked his way into the task. Afterward, he thought it had gone quite well, not brilliantly, but decently enough. But when he looked up again, Gabor's eyes were shining with triumph.
"I'm impressed, boys. Why don't you take a 20-minute break so you can get to know each other?" Dr. Brandt said, obviously pleased.
So Hans and Gabor dressed to go out into the garden, their footsteps creaking against the frozen ground. The snow was falling in large flakes. It was a cold day, and Hans suddenly made out a faint wheeze, a high four-times-accented G, audible on every third or fourth exhalation. It was a kind of vulnerability that contrasted with the fiery nature of the boy's aura.
"What are you training in?" Hans said.
Gabor appeared to pause for thought.
"Self-defense."
That was too vague for Hans.
"In what way?" he said.
"I can show you."
Gabor's body tensed, and the faint wheeze of his breathing came down a semitone to an F-sharp, which made Hans inattentive. That was part of his curse. Over the course of those years, when the soundscape changed, he would compulsively analyze the notes in his surroundings. That was why he was not on his guard when Gabor grabbed hold of him. It was as if he had fallen into a trap. He was spun around with violent force and struck the ground, and for a few seconds he saw nothing. Then he sensed Gabor's eyes above him, replete and satisfied, as if they belonged to a predator that had gotten what it wanted. Then he was gone, Reke lay there with a shooting pain in the back of his head, and only after the third or fourth attempt did he manage to get to his feet and stagger into the house. His hair was sticky and wet, and he stood in front of the bathtub on the ground floor for a long time, trying to stop the flow of blood. By the time he returned to the library, some 15 or 20 minutes had elapsed. Dr. Brandt, still at the desk, indicated with exaggerated gestures and a look of deep disappointment that Gábor had gone home. He never noticed that Reke was injured and pale. Nor indeed did Reke's mother. She was preoccupied the whole evening, searching for a couple of pieces of jewellery that had suddenly gone missing. Chapter 2 Police Constable Michaela Vargas from Husby had moved in with Professor Hans Reke of Grevgatan in Stockholm's most refined neighbourhood, something which had gotten everyone around her all worked up and had set them to gossiping. But now she wanted out. Reke was depressed and hopeless, and he barely emerged from the bedroom. As soon as he had pulled himself together just a little, she would head over there to pack up her stuff. But first of all, she wanted to bring to a close the case they had embarked upon. It was to do with a woman who had been declared dead, but who had possibly made an appearance in a recently taken holiday snap in Venice. And while Michaela didn't really believe in any of that, there was something about the story that titillated her. That was why she had come to the police station on Bergsgatan to meet Inspector Kai Lindrus, who had investigated the incident almost 14 years earlier. But Kai Lindrus was taking his time, which didn't surprise her. He'd sounded recalcitrant and grumpy on the phone, and she was standing a little listlessly in reception on the ground floor, staring out at the street. A truck drove by with a pack of screeching sixth formers celebrating their graduation in the back. It was June 5th, 2004, a glorious summer's day, and she was on the brink of chucking it in and leaving when she heard a voice behind her.
"My private investigator colleague, I presume?" She turned around and shook his hand.
He was younger than she had imagined, barely 50, with big brown eyes and back-combed blonde hair. But he was also seedier. He looked at her as if it were 5 to 3 in the morning. She tugged her denim jacket closer to her body. "I'm grateful you agreed to see me," she said.
"Claire Lidman's dead," Kai Lindrus said.
"Probably. But I still think this is somewhat interesting," she said, touching her inside pocket. "I promise to be brief." Inspector Lindrus continued to eye her body.
"You can be as brief as you like, but I still don't believe it."
Michaela wished she had something to ram down his throat. "Maybe you could take a look at the picture before you make up your mind," she said, following him into the elevator. Of course, Kai Lindrus was going to take a look at the photo, and it was obviously downright ridiculous to be bugged by the fact that the girl was so young and an immigrant to boot. On the other hand, it wasn't that easy to fend off one's prejudices, especially where the Lidman investigation was concerned. It was the gaping wound of his career, and there was most definitely something peculiar about the whole business. A beautiful, well-educated woman who had negotiated with business high flyers for a living had disappeared without trace 14 years ago, only to turn up a few months later burned to a crisp in a petrol tanker crash in Spain. Of course, he had pondered it all 1,000 times since then. Then again, fuck it. That was all history, and it was a Friday afternoon. He really should be off home soon to get drunk, and maybe even have a crack at the wife. It had to be worth a try, at the least.
"So, you work in youth crime?" he said.
"I try to do other stuff in my free time."
"I bet you do. I like your denim jacket," he said.
But he actually meant her tits, and he scrutinized her from head to toe again. Her legs could have done with being longer, and it wouldn't have hurt for her to smile a bit more, but it would be churlish to complain. They stepped into his office, and he shuffled some papers out of the way on his desk. Outside the open window, the sixth formers were screaming away as the parade of trucks passed by. He was tempted to say something scornful about them, but he didn't want to come across as out of touch.
"What a party," he said. "Almost makes you wish you were down there."
"Almost," she said.
"Did you scream when they let you out for the last time?"
for all I was worth. Can't have been that long ago, I suppose.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?